10:07.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. While everything else in China appears to be in some flux, at least the Communist Party continues to provide a certain amount of predictability. The 16th Party Congress has closed in Beijing, adhering to the maxim of Deng Xiaoping that one should observe coolly, plant one's feet stably, and respond calmly. Enter the new leader of the world's most populous country, the so-called colorless 59-year-old bureaucrat Hu Jintao, about whom little is known except that he's been in waiting for the past 10 years. The shift, the change worth watching, is a commercial one. The acquisition of private land, the boom of retail like the 1.2 million square feet of Shanghai shopping now available at the Superbrand Mall. And the point worth watching now is the degree to which this roaring private sector is welcomed into the Chinese Communist Party. It will likely be under the leadership of the unproven Hu Jintao that a reconciliation, of sorts, between communism and capitalism will succeed or fail. Connection listeners, one business leader is quoted as saying that, quote, to get rich together is the final goal of a socialist society. Hello? Is there anything left of communism in China? Or is it just another Asian regime, albeit the largest, under an old name? How long can a totalitarian government coexist with an unfettered commercial sector? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio today, Joseph Fewsmith. He's a professor of international relations and political science at Boston University and the author of numerous books, including China Since Tiananmen, The Politics of Transition. And from Beijing, our own NPR correspondent, Rob Gifford. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rob, let me start with you. This new gang, the cover was pulled off. Should we look at them and expect any sudden changes?
I don't think we should expect many changes at all. The gang is very much a Shanghai gang. That means they are Jiang Zemin's gang. Jiang Zemin is the former party leader of Shanghai, China's second city, and six members of the new standing committee of the Politburo are very close Jiang Zemin allies. He has stacked the Politburo with his allies so that he can continue to pull the strings from behind the screen now that he has officially stepped down. So I think over the next couple of years, Hu Jintao, the new general secretary, is going to have some problems implementing his own policies. It does raise the question, though, of, well, if he were able to implement his own policies, would they actually be any different from the ones that Jiang Zemin is implementing? There is quite a large consensus across the board in China among the leaders now that there is two things needed, political stability and economic development. So, I mean, there's a lot of debate about whether Jiang Zemin will be pulling the strings, but when it boils down to it, I wonder how much it actually matters because there's so much agreement at the top of which way to go on so many things.
Joseph Fewsmith, do we even know what Hu Jintao stands for?
Well, you're right that he stands for, to the extent that we know, political firmness. He demonstrated that in his actions in Tibet back in 1988-89.
He was pretty tough there, wasn't he?
He was very tough there. But he also stands for economic development. It was interesting when he was out at the Central Party School. He headed that organization for many years. He at least opened it up to lots of ideas. And so you had at least a sense of listening, not necessarily accepting ideas, but of listening.
So, Rob, is he seen as someone who basically acts like a chameleon, adapting to whatever change seems appropriate? Or has he got some leader in him, some ideas that will come through?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I mean, I think if you're talking about the ordinary Chinese people, I don't think they've got the slightest idea. They have no access to the ins and outs of a leader's private lives, or even private thoughts, or even public thoughts, hardly. There's so little known about Chinese leaders here. I think the China-watching community, and certainly, of course, we journalists among them, I think we're looking very closely and, as always, trying to read the tea leaves and trying to work out what he's all about. I think the reason he's survived so long, as you mentioned in your intro, he survived a decade as the heir apparent, is simply because he doesn't stick his head above the parapet. There's plenty of history of heirs apparent in China who have started to assert themselves, and they've been cut down to size pretty quickly. So I think it's very, very interesting. He's going to be controlled, as we said earlier, to a certain degree by Jiang Zemin in the first few years. But as he starts to gain his own power, I think we could see some different things emerging. And I think the main reason for that is because the times they are changing. As you mentioned very clearly in your intro, China is changing so fast that I think he could indeed have things forced upon him whereby he's going to have to take a change of tack, a change of policy. And of course, one of those areas specifically is in political reform.
Now, Joseph Hugh Smith, one of the things that I've been listening to in Rob's reporting over the past few weeks setting up this whole conference is the degree to which people don't seem to be particularly engaged or interested in the political change. From your perspective, does that mean that the new leadership is less relevant than, you know, this is the fourth generation, am I right?
So-called fourth generation, yes. Those designations you can argue about, that's the official line. Deng considered himself second generation. I consider him the second half of the first generation, but let's not quibble about those things. You're right.
Who's driving this bus, though? Is it the capitalists or is it the communists?
Are there communists left in China? I don't think that you could find anybody in the party, certainly not anybody in political authority, who believes in communism as it's been traditionally defined. And I welcome that change. What you have here, I think, is a society that you've seen in Asia and elsewhere of a political elite and entrepreneurial elite that have now are coalescing. I think that that's generally a good sort of thing to have happen. But it doesn't you're right that most people assume that it means very little change for their life. Nobody goes out and reads the editorial in People's Daily anymore to see what's in fashion. They just don't care. And I think that's also a very welcome change.
What about the entrepreneurs, Rob? You've done some reporting on them. Are they interested in being a part of the party?
They're interested to the extent that it'll help them to earn more money, I think. I think the situation now is that China, I agree with Joe's comment when he asks, are there any communists left in China? I mean, I think the communists are capitalists, and bizarrely, the capitalists are communists because they're joining the so-called Communist Party in order to get good guanxi, good relations with the top leaders. Because guess what? It's still a one-party state. They may have dropped all the Maoism and the Marxism and the Leninism, but it's still a one-party state. So who controls where the money goes? Who controls what happens when a Western company wants to come into China? Well, it's the Communist Party still. So if you want to be in on the capitalist action, you need to schmooze the right people. And that's what's happening now. Now, some people, some capitalists, some entrepreneurs say, look, I don't want to be a party member. I can't waste my time with all the meetings, with all that kind of stuff. But some people are saying it just actively helps them. It actually helps them to make more money because they're in with the in crowd. They're in with the people who are running the show.
But when you get the people who are making all the money cozying up to the people who have the power, don't you have a recipe for even more corruption, even greater gaps of equality and potentially people at some point just saying, no, we're not going to play by these rules anymore?
I think that's exactly what you're going to have. That's exactly what you're already having. I mean, we do talk a lot about the wealth that has been created, especially in the last decade. Jiang Zemin himself boasted the other day of China's GDP tripling in the 13 years he's been in power. That is quite extraordinary. I mean, you just can't deny those economic facts. But there are a lot of disenfranchised people now. There are a lot of losers. The gap between the rich and the poor is increasing. For 20 years, you had a lot of winners. China was so poor in 1978 that the only way was up. And so people got wealthy. A lot of people got more wealthy than they had been before. What's happened now is the economy has started to slow down. A lot of people have been laid off from the state-owned enterprises, and the losers are gaining. There are more losers in Chinese society now. And it's those people, as you rightly suggest, who could start to say, and indeed are already starting to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm not getting any of this action, I'm not getting any of this economic action, and I'm not going to stand for this.
I think that was one of the things that maybe we were hoping to see in this political report, was more of a giving some sort of voice to these complaints. I certainly welcome Zhang welcoming capitalist entrepreneurs into the party. He spoke of enlarging the middle class. We'd love to see a larger middle class in China and not just the emergence of a very wealthy, small, thin stratum at the top of the society. But you would also hope at the same time that he would voice a little bit more of the demand of these people for social justice, that, as you mentioned, corruption is a major topic in Chinese society. It always tops the polls of people's discontent. You know, rightly or wrongly, many of the people promoted to the Politburo Standing Committee are widely rumored to be corrupt. What sort of signal does this send to Chinese society? I think this is one of the problems that they're going to have to deal with.
Well, is this going to be Hu Jintao's problem, to try and find a measure of social justice in a one-party state where he's got all these apparatchiks around him?
Well, I think that people were hopeful that Hu Jintao, having spent much of his career in the interior of China, in Gansu and Guizhou and Tibet, had a better understanding than most of these, what Rob called Shanghai gang, of the problems of the poor, impoverished inland areas. I don't see Hu Jintao as having a free hand to do almost anything for the next 5 years.
Because of the way he'll be constrained by Jiang Zemin's influence on the Politburo? On the
Absolutely. Yeah. Jiang Zemin has more supporters on the Politburo Standing Committee now than he did before the 16th Party Congress. His party, his power and influence has not waned, it's grown. I don't know if Rob would agree.
What do you think, Rob?
Yeah, I think it definitely has. And that's what's so bizarre, because this whole thing has been touted as the institutionalization of Chinese politics. Jiang was being praised for stepping down. Chinese leaders don't step down. Emperors never used to step down. And, you know, Deng was in charge until he died. Before that, Mao was in charge until he died. So I think this whole idea that Jiang has put in place a sort of institutionalization of you get to 70, you step down, has shown to be a rather an empty boast. I agree with Joe.
Connection listeners, for the last, 12 years now, we've been looking at and comparing the difference between the Chinese model, the Russian model, what comes first, democracy, capitalism. Is China moving forward in the news that you're seeing from Beijing and Shanghai, the change in that country, or is the country heading for some serious trouble? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, for an hour on what's going on in China and whether or not the unveiling of the new Politburo today, and a president about whom we know so very little is in fact going to make a difference in the direction of the country's policy and its economic relations with the rest of the world? Will the WTO have more to do with guiding China than Hu Jintao? With me on the program, Rob Gifford. He's our correspondent. He's based in Beijing. He's been covering the 16th Party Congress. Here in the studio with me, Joseph Fewsmith, professor of international relations and political science at Boston University. And to both of you, the name that, you know, sort of gets tossed around and then completely ignored is that of Chairman Mao. Is that he remains in some way as an important figure in Chinese history, but in no way as an example or as someone whose ideas are still held. How is that squared?
Well, I think Mao is still, and it seems a bit ironic from an outsider's perspective, but in China, he still is an icon of China standing up politically, of unifying the country, of ending an era of imperialism, and so forth. This is the way he is still, I think, revered. And it's amazing in talking to the common people on the street how consistent this image is. But obviously, one of the things that Mao didn't do and contributed mildly in the other direction is he didn't make China stand up economically. And that's, of course, what Deng Xiaoping and now Jiang Zemin are trying to do.
So that's how people, Rob, manage the contradiction?
I think so. I think there's general respect, as Joe says, for Mao as the nation builder. He brought China disintegrated in 1911. He brought it together again in 1949. But after 1949, really, he just gave it a lot of trouble. I mean, a lot of people say if he died in kind of 1952, China could have avoided 30 years of terrible, dislocation and death of the deaths of millions of people. What I notice just talking to people living in China here is that those losers we were talking about it a bit earlier, it's the losers who like Chairman Mao, because they may have been poor in the old days, but at least they were equal in their poverty, whereas now all the Communist Party members have got rich and a lot of people have become disenfranchised. The winners don't like Mao at all, of course, because the winners, the people who've got rich and they've got their fancy new car and their new apartment, their cell phone and their laptop, those people love Deng Xiaoping, and they can't put Chairman Mao far enough behind them.
Rob, just one question before we turn to our callers. Joseph has written a couple of papers, which I was reading, about Jiang Zemin's speech in July of 2000 and how that was the dramatic moment when he signaled an opening to the entrepreneurs and the capitalist classes. And yet I'm seeing through bits and pieces of the reporting of this Congress that there's a bit of a slowdown there, that China may not be ready to be quite as opening to the venture capitalists as Jiang was indicating. Is that happening? Do you see anything like that?
Well, I think there's a tremendously a danger of destabilization in going too fast. I hate to sound like Jiang Zemin in saying this, but this, of course, is what he says. I mean, they're trying to do it slowly. They look at the Soviet Union, and the thing they want to avoid is the Soviet Union, where the whole place just crumbled overnight. And they say, oh, stability is the most important thing, so we can't go too fast on allowing in venture capital, in implementing WTO suddenly overnight. That's why they've spread it over 5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. They just can't have that kind of tidal wave of Western companies, of lowering tariffs, of all the implications of those economic changes. And, I think a lot of people watching say, well, yeah, China has been much smarter in the way they've reformed. But of course, and in many ways, that's true. They're smarter than the Soviet Union. But then the Communist Party does tend to do one thing, and that is to sort of hide behind this argument of stability. They say, oh, we don't want to be like the Soviet Union, and that's their kind of excuse for doing nothing. And the people who really want some kind of proper political reform in China, these people are really very annoyed at the way the Chinese government says, oh, stability, we can't risk anything, because they just hide behind that in order to do nothing.
But the one exception to that, Joseph, is that stability is also what happens to work well for business. So what might have crumbled years ago continues to survive because they agree on that one thing, that stability is a good place, good word for investment, right?
Absolutely. I think the issue here is job creation. As Rob suggested, we've laid off millions and millions of workers from these failing state-owned enterprises over the years. Many of them are in their 40s or 50s and are probably unemployable again in the new economy. These are the losers that like Chairman Mao. But beyond that, and one of the things the Communist Party is trying to do is get the entrepreneurs to create jobs. Jobs in the state-owned sector are very, very expensive. They require a lot of money, state subsidies. You cannot employ the numbers of people in China that way, and so they're trying to get the entrepreneurs to do that. What you've had in the last several years is quite interesting because it's been essentially a jobless growth. The entrepreneurs are going into often buying up state-owned enterprises and then laying off people, so the economy does well. But a lot of people do not do well. Mm-hmm. And so what we have to look for in the next few years, I think, is whether they really start creating jobs. If they don't, I think the problems that Rob's alluded to are going to be quite serious.
1-800-423-8255. First to Raleigh, North Carolina. Laura's on the line. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Laura. Hi.
I'll be Dick. You be Laura.
Okay.
What do you think?
My question is, I'm interested in your guests' views of the rise, if they see an impact and a rise due to the influence of provincial governments and exercising some autonomy versus Beijing. I work for a Fortune 100 global company. We're looking at, siting a plant, in fact, specifically in China, and we are getting messages from the provincial government that don't worry about Beijing, don't worry about getting that business license. We'll give you tax credits and things that will offset what they would give you, that kind of thing.
Rob, what's your sense of this one? I'll get you to handle
it. Yeah, I think this is a very, very important issue. It's an important issue, of course, for businesses because you want to know if that's correct or whether Beijing is going to interfere in any way. I think it's a blessing and a curse, the sort of decentralization of Chinese politics and economics over the last 20 years. It's freed up, it's given the provinces a lot of freedom to do some of the things that they want to, but at the same time, the local officials have also created a lot of problems. They've created their own little fiefdoms. So some of the things that, for instance, Premier Zhu Rongji wants to do to reform some of the economic and political sort of bottlenecks in the provinces just are not getting implemented because the guys in the provinces say they sort of, yeah, they tip their forehead to the Premier, but then do nothing about it and don't do what he says. So I think there's one of the center's biggest problems is to get these people to implement good policies. And as an investor, I think you have to be, I would say you have to be as wary of the local officials as you do of Beijing. In my experience, I'm not a specific economic reporter, but in my experience, there are quite a lot of good policies that come down from Beijing that don't get implemented in the provinces, and there's a lot of obstructionism. There's a lot of local protectionism in the provinces, and many a foreign company has come to grief by going into some area of the country that they didn't really know much about, and they've been stung by a company that's stolen their intellectual property, or they've had to ally with a local official who then went and stole some money from them or did something that was not beneficial to them. So,
Laura, do you do any travel in China yourself?
No, I haven't been there yet. I hope to. I have the thing I'm wondering about, do you see any potential, especially under the recent change in leadership, that Beijing will react and, say, slap the hands of the provincial governments, or are they essentially powerless to punish provinces who don't implement Beijing policy?
Joseph, why don't you take this one?
Well, I think that's one of the issues as you're facing China's entry into the WTO. I think that China in Beijing is trying to develop a core of bureaucrats, if you will, who really do understand the WTO regulations and will try to enforce them at the local level. That's a process that I'm afraid is going to take several years, maybe many years. So I think we're going to be dealing with the problems of provincial, I'm not sure if autonomy is the right word, but certainly going their own ways on trying to implement some of these policies for a good bit of time.
Thanks for your call, Laura. We're at 1-800-423-8255 to Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Charlie's joining us. Hi, Charlie.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have more an observation than a question. It seems to me that the comparison to the Soviet Union is a good one and a bad one all at the same time. Governments seem to stand on two legs, one economic and one political. The Soviet Union seemed to have devolved into near chaos because there was no political leg to, I'm sorry, no economic leg to stand on when the political leg tried to move forward. I think what you might see in China at the moment is, since the economic leg is moving forward first, that the politics are really going through what in Russia was probably the Khrushchev to Brezhnev era, where the outside dissidents constantly putting low-level pressure onto the government gradually had it releasing freedoms to the people, to the point where the people's momentum gathered and democracy was able to come forward.
And if we follow your argument through, that means that there will be some significant political unrest in China, perhaps 20 years down the line.
Yes, maybe at the time when the people who lived through Tiananmen have worked their way up into either the private sector or the public sector, and are in a position to open their voice. There are those in this country who were politically active in the 60s and are now finding those spirits stirring again.
I'm wondering, Joseph, if the I don't know if it was you or Rob saying earlier in the program that the Chinese are watching very carefully what's happening in the Soviet Union. You continue to watch what's happening in Russia, the former Soviet Union, and whether or not the lesson extends to the extent that that Charlie's suggesting.
Well, I think you should look in two directions. One is the former Soviet Union, Russia. The party, including the Central Party School, has studied this example extremely carefully. Many academics have spent a lot of time trying to say what went wrong. How much reform do you have to have? What levers of control do you have to hold on to?
So Jeffrey Sachs is not going to be invited to Beijing to advise them on this.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
The other direction to look at, an interesting comparison, is Taiwan. If you reel back the clock to, say, the mid-1970s, it looked an awful lot like China today. It was a one-party dictatorship with a booming economy. And it took Taiwan another decade or so before it began to open up politically. So I think size matters. Evolution in China will happen more slowly. But I think if you're looking down the road 10 or 20 years, sure, I think you're going to see some very significant political change.
I think the comparison with Taiwan is quite a good one in many ways, except what you mentioned at the end there, Joe, the size. Taiwan is smaller than the smallest Chinese province, 22 million people, and China is 1.3 billion, so and is also not as homogenous. So I think there's a lot more people to bring along with them on the economic reforms. Not everybody's boat is rising with the tide. Mm-hmm. The one thing I would just say to the caller to add to that is that when he mentions the sort of Khrushchev to Brezhnev era in the 60s, I don't see, although I suppose I do agree to some extent with the time frame, you're talking about 10, 15 into 20 years before we really start to see some kind of democracy emerging. I just don't see the comparison with the 1960s Soviet Union. Why? Because the Chinese Communist Party has been quite smart. What they've done, I would say there are three legs. There's not just politics and economics. There's society, there's social issues. And what the Chinese have done, they have loosened the economy and they have loosened the society. And they've given the Chinese people a living space, which the Russian people, the people in the Soviet Union, did not have in the 1960s. They didn't have that living space. And a lot of Chinese people have bought this. They've said, it's like there's been an unspoken deal between the party and the people. The party says, you stay out of politics, economic and social affairs, you do whatever you want. And people have said, hey, after 50 years of turmoil, where I couldn't avoid politics in any way, I'll buy that, I'll take that. And so they're staying out of politics just as the party wants them to.
It's the one thing, Rob, that you put your finger on that always, for me, marks the distinction between what's happening in China and what was happening in Russia, and that is land. That is the ability to buy land, to own land, to sit on land. That's still a big problem in Russia, but the Chinese appear to have that in hand.
Well, that's interesting you raise that, because in Jiang Zemin's speech last Friday, he raised the issue of land. He talked about the ability to buy land for the first time. Private property of all sorts of commodities and everything has been traded in China in the last 20 years, but the land still belongs to the government. Now, if we are really moving to a point, as he suggested in his speech, where land is going to be traded, then I agree with you. We really are starting to move into the realms uncharted territory that could open things up a lot further.
I agree with you, Rob. That was in the agricultural policy document that came out in August, and he's obviously reinforced that. I would also add to that the transfer of housing to private individuals. People have been able to buy housing for a fraction of the cost of building it. This has been the great housing giveaway. Reminds me a little bit of Singapore that way. And all of a sudden you have millions of people in the cities and now, as you're suggesting, in the countryside with a stake in the society. And so they are also examining very carefully, how do you build a middle-class society? So they are looking to these sorts of things for stability.
So one of the things that maybe the Russians did get right was giving the apartments to the people who were occupying them so they could immediately sell them for the market price. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation about the economic and political change that's underway in China, particularly in reference to the new leadership, which was unveiled a little bit earlier today. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR News.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. This hour, China, at a moment of particularly interesting political and economic change, but gosh, how many times have we said that? And it just keeps lumbering ahead. Growth rates going up and the Communist Party, in effect, doing sort of what it wants behind those closed doors at the Great Hall of the People. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Let's go first to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Linda's on the phone. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. First of all, I just want to say thank you to Mr. Gifford. In the past, he has brought in quite a lot of exciting news from China. I really like his report.
And take a bow, Rob.
Thank you very much, Linda. Thank you. Take a bow. Yeah.
All right. I just regarding this newly elected Chinese the top leadership. I agree with the speaker a moment ago. I do not think there will be quite a big change, a policy switch. in the short run, but in long run, maybe after 5 years, depends on Mr. Hu's position, power in the party, we probably can expect some changes. But if you just look at the resume of those top eight people, most of them, six or seven of them, they had this electrical engineer background. People seem to be pretty much narrowed in the field. That's something you can pretty much see Mr. Zhang's influence in the future. But I think it's a pity because I talked to my friends and relatives over there, because in the future, China is facing more change. It needs more change and more improvement in many aspects, political, legal, you know, many other aspects. But you do not see any people from that background coming to the...
Linda, you're living here in the United States now?
Yeah.
And you have families living in China?
Yeah, and relatives. I've been supporting international firms coming to China, open China market for many years. So,
how is their life in China now? Friends, family, what are they telling you about their life?
Well, the people just saying in the past, people have been suffered quite a lot because they, because of their political attitude or because of their political opinion. So people seem to be, most of you seem just careless. In Beijing, people say, we don't care. It's the same thing again and again. Not that much.
So that means people stay out of politics, Linda?
But I think people in China shows less interest than people in the West. Because the people in the West probably concern more, yeah, what about change, policy change, or change reflect our foreign policy into China, blah, blah, blah. But in China, people care more about, oh, we just hope this change can only help us to economically get more improvement. So that's something people are more concerned.
And is what you're hearing, that life is getting better for people generally?
Well, I think the life, it really depends. Because people in the past, if they working in a state-owned company, everything is guaranteed. You don't have to work hard. You know, you got insurance, you got housing, everything. People in that group, they are really missing the old times. But I also knew a lot of millionaires, people in top level. They really, you know, of course, people get a benefit. They certainly see something good about the current policy. But again, I think as long as the government still, the top leadership, they still keep it. The country into the right direction, which at this moment is economic improvement rather than in the past time too much political struggle. I think China still have hope to move further.
Rob Gifford.
I think Linda put her finger right on it. I mean, basically, China wasted 30 years under Mao. I mean, I think Chinese people here are very much aware of that wasted time. Maybe it didn't seem like a waste at the time. They were making revolution, and what Mao said was law and was gospel. But I think people are just, they're trying desperately to catch up with the West. There's very much a feeling here of a sort of inferiority complex, especially
inferior to who, Rob? Inferior
to the West.
Yeah.
There's always a feeling that the West has looked down on China, which indeed it has. The West, you know, should be ashamed of some of the things that it has done in China over the last 200 years. But the Chinese are very, very sensitive to this, and they're very sensitive to the fact that they're poorer, that they're much poorer than the West. So as though they're trying to make up for that. They're trying to make up for the 30 wasted years under Mao, and they are just wanting to go full steam ahead. And I think there's a lot of people here who, of course, they don't like some of the policies of the government, and they have their own gripes about human rights issues, and as, of course, you know, we all do. But talking to people here, there's very much a sense of, well, why is the West always concentrating on human rights? This is what people say to me the whole time. Of course there's human rights issues, but just look at us. We're trying. We're so far behind you. Just let us just make some economic progress first, and then let's kind of really, once we're on a level playing field with you guys, well, then let's talk about whether we can have the same standards. And even ordinary people whose human rights are being affected or infringed upon by the government say this. I mean, it's really, really striking the way that comes across.
Though,
from
Joseph, it
people.
Seems to me that the human rights issue is a whole lot lower profile in the United States today than it might have been 10, 15, 20 years ago, when it seemed in many ways that was was the only subject because the economic conversation wasn't there to be had.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. The conversation does continue, and it's an important one, and it's an important element in Sino-U.S. relations. We do talk about it, but it's no longer the issue. It doesn't dominate everything, and I think that's good. I mean, I think that it's a much more realistic approach that recognizes the tremendous changes that China is undergoing. It's also an approach that I believe assumes that human rights will gradually improve over the next 10 or 20 years as the economy improves.
All right, Linda, thanks a lot for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Stephanie now, who's joining us from Worcester, Mass. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello, how are you today?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I'm just curious. This has been so interesting. We've had so many emerging democracies since World War II, Israel, Turkey, Germany even. They've not selected our republic type of government. Have you posited of possibly where China might go if they get to choose from the best of everything around the world?
Right, or if there's even a model that they're looking at. Joseph, why don't you start on that? I guess not.
I think that you're getting a little ahead of where the elite is, but it allows me to pick up a point that Linda made just a moment ago about this very technocratic elite, all trained as engineers. I think that there is a widespread assumption among the political elite and the intellectuals in China that democracy means finding the right answer, that if you've consulted the right people and come up with the objectively correct answer, that's what democracy really is, and that the problem with the Chinese Communist Party in the past is that it hasn't consulted the right people. Now, that's very, very different from our conception of democracy, which is that everybody has a chance to voice whatever opinion they want. And so you really do have this sense of designing policies and trying to implement them from the top down. And so is China looking ahead at a model for democratization? Only in this very, very limited sense of sort of a elite consultative democracy, if I can use that word.
I remember, Rob, back in the early 90s when I was covering Georgia's decision to separate from the USSR. I got pinned up against the wall of the Parliament building there by a bunch of young Georgians who said, "So how are the Quebecers doing it in Canada? How do they separate? How does it work?" And I'm wondering whether or not people see you as a Westerner in China and say, you know what, how would it work using an American model, using a British model?
Well, I think, in fact, the American model is, I wouldn't say it's discredited, but I don't think you're ever going to see a Statue of Liberty in Tiananmen Square like you did in 1989. I think the image of America has gone downhill in recent years because of the NATO bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 1999, because of the spy plane affair last year. Of course, it's all a lot more friendly now post 9/11, but I think people see America as a bit of a bully internationally here, and so they're not looking there. Interestingly, one of the places where Hu Jintao has been looking, I think Joe alluded to earlier, is Europe and the social democratic parties of Europe. Some of the people in his think tanks here have been to Western Europe and looked at the social democratic model. They have also looked at the Eastern European model, at how those communist parties in the early 90s basically just changed names and changed hats, and it was a lot of them were the same politicians, but having to function in a democratic or pseudo quasi-democratic system. So I think they are sort of thinking about it. My take on it is that they are aware that something has to change at some point. The thing is, it is such uncharted territory. I mean, not just in communist history, communist party history, but in Chinese history. I mean, you've got thousands of years of imperial rule, and you just don't have any democratic sort of precedents to draw on, like, say, the Eastern Europeans did with being next to Western Europe. So I think they're very worried, in fact. They know that they've got to do something, but they're just not sure what.
Is there, Rob's talking about an awareness that something has to change, Joseph. Is that something born in Beijing, or is that responding to people from outside saying, well, you're not going to be able to sustain this forever?
Well, in my own observations of China, it seems to me that this awareness that things have got to change has really come up or been renewed within the last year or so. And it's really, I think, in reaction to the layoffs of the of workers, to the poverty in the countryside. Prices of grain have actually gone down over the last 4 years, so people in the countryside are having a real tough time. There's been a lot of social disorder of various sorts, whether it's petitioning movements, demonstrations, riots, of course, strikes, things that Rob and his colleagues in Beijing try to report on, but often these are kept out of the press. We don't know about them. So you're getting a sense that social issues are moving to the fore, that somehow these have to be addressed. Somehow the answer has to include some sort of political reform. But I agree with Rob, it's very much uncharted water. How you get to there is just, they don't have answers for it now.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for your call. Now, you two, I want to just see if we can pull some of these threads together. We've been talking about all the things that that face the new leaders. We're talking about state industries in bad shape, the gap between the rich and the poor, corruption, crime, the middle class, foreign companies wanting a bigger role, and Joseph was just talking about social issues and the dispossessed. Rob, if you were to try and put your finger on what rock this country could founder on as the capitalists charge ahead in their own, we'll ignore you if you ignore us, and the Communist Party does exactly the same thing. Where do the two lines cross? Where's the problem going to come?
Oh, wow. There are so many problems. I think it's going to be in the increase of the disenfranchised. I think it's going to be, as WTO kicks in, you're going to see more and more people laid off. You're going to see the wealth gap increasing. You're going to see corruption increasing because more money's coming in, but the power to allocate it is still in the hands of an elite here. And you are just going to gradually see more and more unhappy people, and you're going to see little explosions all over the place. The big, big question, really, well, two questions. Can those explosions, those annoyances, the angry people all get together and organize? I very much doubt it in the short term. And secondly, will the government be proactive in trying to stop that from happening? And the way they would do that is to actively start to implement political change before it's forced upon them, possibly with disastrous effects.
Well, I agree with Rob on those. I think there are a couple of things, though, that we ought to be watching. One is, we're talking about China as if it were a single country. The regional problems are enormous. And if you look, for instance, at this new leadership that's come out, I think Rob referred to them as the Shanghai Gang. They do represent an East Coast bias. This is the, maybe we could call this dot-com China. This is the go-go China of the Shanghai really taking off. If you go into the interior, the rice belt, the Henan, the Hunan, the Hubei, these people are not doing very well. If you go further west, they're even less well. This is very much traditional China that has not partaken of this takeoff.
Boom, yeah.
And then if you think of the northeast, this is where the state-owned economies are really failing. So you have these regional pressures building up, and the party has to deal with those. And that could be difficult. If you had a economic depression, then you have a rock.
Mr. Hu Jintao, we'll send you a transcript of our program. Thanks both of you for coming in. Joseph Fewsmith, Professor of International Relations at Political Science at Boston University. Rob Gifford, NPR correspondent in Beijing. Graham Smith's our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is W.